Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Bandages, I'm whistling at the light. The nurse is looking anxious, and she's quivering with fright. I'm looking through Gary Gilmore's eyes.
Matt, hello.
Tim, how are you, mate?
I'm all right, thank you.
Good man. Are you coming on video as well, or are you just going to stick on the audio for this chat?
Am I not on video? Hang on, let me get that going.
Oops. No worries. Hey, hey. There you are.
You're all working.
Amazing. I'm thrilled that we're finally doing this. It seems like we've been talking about doing it for forever.
Absolutely, yeah. I think
it's taken a global pandemic for us to get in the same room.
The same virtual room, yeah.
Are you still in Devon?
I am indeed, yeah. Yeah, that's my home.
So you grew up down there, right?
I grew up down here and, I was born in Essex, in Hornchurch, and my parents moved down here when I was about 7 or 8, I think it was. And I went to school here and, generally spent most of my ill-spent teenage years down here and then moved up to London when I was in 76 and then moved back down here again 5 years ago.
Were they ill-spent, the teenage years? I imagine Devon is actually just quite like a trouble-free environment for a child, kind of rural and... Fairly simplistic.
Nowhere's trouble free for a child. It's the children are the problem, not the environment.
Yeah. Very true.
No, of course you get up to your normal problems that all kids get up to everywhere, of course.
Was it a happy childhood? Were you a happy kid?
I don't know. I don't know. Am I a happy adult? I don't know. Difficult question to answer, isn't it? Who knows what happiness is? Yeah, I think I always generally enjoy life. But life is comprised of light and shade. If you've only got one side, you're missing something out on the other side. So, the idea of pure happiness is not something I kind of understand.
Have you ever, in all your years, experienced moments of pure joy and happiness where it was just... that was the only emotion in the room at that time?
I'm sure I have. I'm sure if I have, it was fleeting. It's not something you would kind of like cling on to. Otherwise, you're in trouble. Have I experienced pure misery? Yeah, that too.
Yeah.
I don't like to cling on to that either.
You don't like to cling on to that either?
I don't cling on to anything, no.
What about relationships, people?
Well, I cling on to my very close friends here. My relationship now with my partner is very important to me, and probably the most important thing in my life. Other people are important to me, yeah.
I'd like to, I think, discuss to begin with. This might sound like a crass question, and apologies if it does, but obviously your stage name, TV Smith, first band The Adverts, first solo album Channel 5. It seems like from the very beginning there's always been a fascination with the mass media. in your work, the perhaps negative effects on society, on the human race. I was listening to your latest album earlier, Lockdown Holiday. Loved it. And, you know, there's a lot of exploration. It's not just a pandemic like COVID album, but it's about, you know, the human race, humanity, where we're at now. I'd love for you to shed some light on that to begin with. First of all, where that interest began and how you see in your life over the course of, you know, perhaps the evolution of TV into now the internet. I guess TV plays a part still as well, but the kind of effects that you've seen mass media have on us.
Well, the basic problem, of course, is that as soon as you get into mass media, you're being influenced by something outside of yourself. So, you know, friendships and other people, it's a debate. It's something that you exchange between yourselves and you make up your own mind. Mass media is an assault. It's something that is forced upon you without your participation, you know, and it's up to you whether you can resist it and resist the blandishments of it or not. And so I was kind of aware at an early age that that this was something like imposing on my life and on my consciousness and what I believed and what I wanted to do. So that was partly the reason for calling the band The Adverts, you know, as a kind of like criticism or, you know, a comment on that, and making my own stage name TV when, you know, there is no V, it's just Tim, you know, was also part of buying into that that whole idea. And it is something that still fascinates me, and, you know, even more so now than back in the old days when it was just two or three channels on television. You know, now the mass media assaults you in from many angles and in many ways and in much more kind of subtle and pernicious ways than it did back then. And you see it even more in, you know, over the last year when, you know, we've been denied the, you know, quite rightly denied the ability to meet up and you know, engage with each other. And which has left the kind of media a free rein to kind of attempt to influence us. You know, all we're hearing is the government through the television and through social media kind of opinions and ideas that we don't have, we can't respond to.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy how it's advanced and just accelerated at such an unprecedented speed with the advent of the internet and particularly with social media. Like, as you say, back in, you know, the time when you were coming of age, and even when I was coming of age, like, I didn't have the internet in my life till I was like 18, 19. So I remember a complete life without it. And there was five channels when I was a kid, and that was it. I didn't have cable, I didn't have Sky. And the thing was then is you could quite easily escape the bombardment. Now it seems like you can't. I mean, you can, obviously, if you don't have a cell phone and you just, you know, that's in your pocket or out of sight, you can live without that bombardment. But if you do have a phone and you've got all the apps on there, and even when you're just out in public, it's almost impossible in today's world, isn't it, to avoid the barrage of messaging, be it, you know, subliminal or confrontational, or a mixture of the two.
The way it's sneaked in, yeah. You know, I was, well, you mentioned Channel 5 earlier, my first solo album. At that point, you know, I was, you know, a few years into being a professional musician, and there was only four channels. So the idea of Channel 5 was a witty kind of like comment on the what if there was another one, you know? And now, of course, there's 500, and they're all rubbish. You know, there is nothing any good on telly, you know, in my opinion. It's almost all 99% complete rubbish. Made, you know, that we are being fed to the idea that people are sitting in front of this garbage, you know, for hour after hour after hour, while their minds are being sort of wrung out, is I find it incredibly disturbing. You know, when, you know, they could be doing something useful. Well, you know, we have the choice to get away from it, of course. You know, I've got the choice to throw away my cell phone, and I've got a choice not to go on the internet and do this kind of thing with you now. But the thing is, you know, the old expression, throwing the baby away with the bathwater, is that you are actually, if you do just completely say no to it, you do miss the opportunity to feed your message back in. And I don't like my phone going off every 2 minutes, you know, with stuff I can't be bothered with. But this is the way the world is now, and it is the way, and you have to engage with it. I think I do engage with it. I always said I'd never have a computer. I got a computer, you know. I always said I'd never have email. I got email, and they are now my ways to engage with the world. And again, just as social media has been very important in a negative way over the past year, I've been able to use that in a positive way, because I'm not out there on the road. I'm not able to sing to people and give my message to people in real life. So if I had have thrown away my phone, I had have thrown away my computer, or not got in with it in the first place, I wouldn't have been able to make an album saying my position on the world, and I wouldn't have been able to get it out to people either.
Yeah, with this medium that we're talking on now, podcasting, I don't know whether you've done one before or not. I was looking earlier on to see. I couldn't see you on a podcast on any of the podcast apps. Maybe you have done one and I couldn't find it. But what I love about this medium, and I've been, you know, doing interviews and presenting in one lane or another for the last 12 years or so, and I've worked for all like the big rock companies. So I've done like Kerrang, Scuzz, Metal Hammer, Classic Rock. The only company that I still work with is Vive La Rock, because I love Eugene. I think he's a great guy. But I made the conscious decision about 4 or 5 years ago to go completely independent. And going back to the, you know, the technology and the social media as a platform for getting your voice out there, what podcasting really allows me to do, I imagine in a similar way to you, who's been through bands and labels and done all of those things, is this format can allow me to say anything, like talk to anybody about whatever I like for however long I like, no restrictions, and I can get it out there. There's almost a kind of a punk rock, you know, DIY attitude in there, and I would be completely lost without social media and the internet. So it's, as you say, it's like you want to be in it but not of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with that. Yep. And the fact we don't have censorship, you know, is of course incredibly important, because even with you know, if as a musician wanting to get your message across, even in the, if you, you know, got an interview or an article in a magazine, then, you know, you say a bit and you're edited, and it ends up not really being what you're about or what you wanted to say. So the fact these sort of things go out completely unedited and in depth, and you know, is also important.
Yeah, that's always been my mantra since day one, is no edit. Even if it gets awkward, you've got to leave it in and just, you know, have the conversation play as it unfolds. And I love that. There's something just honest and raw and transparent about that. You mentioned Channel 5 a moment ago, Tim. I don't know how you feel about that album now, but for my money, and I haven't heard everything you've done, but I've heard a lot of it, most of it, Channel 5 for me, I think, is my favorite record you've ever made. I think there's not a single song on there that lets the side down. I think every single track is just solid gold, and I absolutely love it. I think it's such a great record. Is it one you're happy and proud with?
Yeah, I love Channel 5, really love it. And it's just a shame it's not really available, you know, because it got into such a mess with rights of ownership. You know, it was paid for by a company that immediately went bankrupt after it was made. So I never got a proper release. And then it got a re-release by a kind of dodgy company who never paid me, and I had to stop them producing it. And now the ownership of rights, who owns it, is kind of all very dubious. So it's a real shame. I think it's a little a gem of an album, yeah. And it's important for me in so many ways. It was post adverts and post explorers, so I was, you know, I'd know after I'd lost my labels, my publisher, my manager, who died tragically. So I had no backing whatsoever. I was completely out on a limb, and all I had to do, wanted to do, was write. So I wrote with no restrictions, no kind of agenda from myself or from any record company or publisher, no commercial agenda. Just wanted to write and expand what, you know, what I was writing about. So the song, all the songs are about really interesting and unusual subjects, which I really like about it. The arrangements are great. You know, I teamed up with some really good musicians, Tim Cross on keyboards and Tim Rennick on guitar, who I went on to work with for many years after that. And on a very low budget, we just, you know, use ideas to make up for a lack of budget. Yeah, I mean, it was an unusual album. You know, it was a complete flop because you couldn't buy it. It didn't sound like anything else at the time, but...
It's aged incredibly well. It sounds so modern still.
This is the weird thing about albums that don't fit in with the time, because you don't make them with an agenda of being contemporary. You know, I always believe that if you're honest about what you want to do and you make the sound of the album fit the songs, then they're going to last. You know, I think that's why the first album, well, I think that's why all the Adverts album still work today better than they did at the time. The second Adverts album particularly sounds much better today than it did at the time. People don't have the expectations, you know. You go back and listen to this stuff now, and without the expectations, oh, it's supposed to sound like this. This is what's going on now. It's supposed to sound like that. Why doesn't it sound like that? Oh, it's rubbish. If it doesn't, you know, you have a clear view of what it's supposed to, you know, what it actually sounds like, why it sounds like that, how it fits the songs.
Yeah, Cast of a Thousand is a great record as well. I love that album. And it's kind of strange, isn't it, that often it's called the difficult second album for a reason. And, you know, throughout history, it seems like you have a successful first album that everybody loves, and like 9 times out of 10, all everybody wants is for you to do the same thing again. Yes. And it's like, oh, well, why would I do that? I've already done it. So then you do something different, and then they go, oh, well, it's not the same. And you're like, well, of course it's not the same.
Yeah, I mean, you know, my aim wasn't to be the Ramones and do every album the same as the last one. And as you say, I had no interest in making the same album again. And it was, you know, when people say it's a difficult second album, well, you know, when you break it down, what's difficult is a difficulty that you don't get it, you know, or is a difficulty for me that I can't make a good second album. For me, it wasn't difficult. You know, it was an absolute blast making that second Adverts album with all the exciting ideas and arrangements and different kinds of songs. You know, I was sailing going through that album thinking, well, this is really, you know, breaking the mold, you know, really breaking out from what the first Adverts album was. And I admit, the mastering was bad, you know, and it did sound a bit weedy. Yeah, well, tough, you know, but, you know, we remastered it later and it sounded a lot better. But that's not, you know, so what? You know, that sort of thing is not what makes or breaks an album. It was a bit unfortunate, but the album itself stands up, I think.
Well, there's the other side of it is with a community and a scene and a genre like punk, is it's obviously meant to be about, you know, free creativity, and there's no rules, there's no restrictions. And as we both know throughout history, from the birth of punk still to today, you have the group of elitists that like to have their checklist. And if it doesn't meet all of those points, then it's not punk in their eyes. And you're like, okay. And I guess you guys kind of copped a bit of that flack, as many of your contemporaries did. But again, it's like, what are you going to do? You're just going to be, you know, make an anarchy in the UK forever.
Yeah, well, the Pistols, of course, had the great luck of breaking up after one album, so no one was able to judge them on the difficult second album.
Yeah,
you know, yeah, it's a weird kind of movement that says, yeah, do anything you want, but don't do that.
What was the impact of the Pistols on that scene at that time? I saw the BBC documentary that they made with you a while back when it first came out. I saw it, and you were sort of saying in that, as I've seen many bands say, like the Clash say it in their documentary, Buzzcocks have said it, it seems like they were the catalyst for so much, and you know, as much of a hard time as certain members of that band perhaps get today in the public forums and the press and stuff. Well, I guess they've always had shit thrown at them in the press, but were they the band that kick-started most of that movement in the UK at that time, in terms of just like that, they were the initial spark.
I would say that's fair, yeah. Yeah. I mean, of course there was other stuff going on. I mean, you know, would you have had, you couldn't have had punk without Bowie, without Alice Cooper, without Iggy, without Roxy Music. I don't think you could have had that movement without any of those. But the thing was, in 76, it was the Pistols that were out going, doing these little club gigs and suddenly sparked off the media interest, you know, that allowed, created the space where that thing could happen. And, you know, and I'd never seen Iggy live. But when I saw the Pistols in London in 76, you know, I mean, I was completely bowled over. I thought, what an extraordinary frontman, you know. So, you know, I mean, the heavy metal kids had a little bit of that, you know, frontman who was sneery, kind of like anti-hero frontman. But Rotten just topped Gary Holt, and, you know, just like that, really. You know, he was amazing to watch. And the band were great. It was just like they were there. They were a real band. They were right in front of your eyes when you saw them live, and they really made you feel, well, I could do that. You know, I mean, I was already in bands in Devon before I moved up to London, but there was no connection. You couldn't get a connection with the audience like that. You know, people weren't up for it. So at a Pistols gig, they were there, right in front of your eyes. People just like us, and the audience were up for it. You know, it was that magic combination, the right thing at the right time, the right band, the right audience.
And did the establishment truly hate it? You know, because you see the coverage in the press, you know, you see it from today's eyes, and it seems ludicrous that they would be on the front page with the headlines like The Filth and the Fury, and, you know, like, this is a threat to society. I wonder if you could shed some light on that, on the whole fiasco that the British press made out of not just the Sex Pistols, but the whole punk movement, and how they tried to vilify and condemn. And,
well, that's what they do. I mean, that's what they do it now, you know, whether it's with, you know, Meghan and Harry, or what, whoever they set their sights on to be the new targets of outrage. And, you know, that's the way they work, really, you know, create heroes and villains, and turn life into a soap opera. That's the way we're drawn into the whole thing. I mean, the kind of side effect from that attitude was that punk was, you know, was grew wings and flew, because you know, when it doesn't matter, as everyone knows, whether it's good publicity or bad publicity, it's publicity. And and it puts you in the public eye, and increases your profile, and, you know, and that's what allows movements like that to take off. So whether they were saying it was this evil, or whether they were saying it was fantastic, it's the same difference in the end. You know, it gave it space to grow. And
what about if you're living through it, though? Like, was it not tiresome? And
I don't know what, you know, my life's just...
Was it dangerous, and do you want to fix it, or are you good?
I'll just get myself back in the light.
No worries.
Ooh, there we are.
There we go.
Yeah, lighting engineer as well.
Was there not a strain on, I mean, because you guys must have caught a little bit of that controversy wave around Gary Gilmore's eyes and what that song was about, and when it came out, like, is it tiresome being in the middle of that storm and just trying to live your life and be an artist and a creative, and, you know, being accused of all these other things which seem a little bit far removed from what you're actually trying to do?
I'm sure it was for the Pistols. I mean, I'm sure it was awful for them, you know, to actually have to be you know, to be seen as public enemy number one, when, you know, all they'd done was a few gigs and, you know, and being rude about the Queen, big deal, you know. But society was very, very reactionary and very backward and conservative in those days. You know, that, you know, it needed the doors kicked down, that's for sure. Because, you know, anyone who gets upset about such trivial things now seems absurd, but that's the way it was in 1976. You know, society was very, very narrow-minded. So that made it, in a way, even more brave what they did. Just to go up against, oh, well, we're going to do it. We're going to sing these songs, and we're going to be this snotty nose band, and nothing like Emerson, Lake and Palmer. You know, so for me personally, I don't think we didn't really get that kind of reaction. You know, the worst thing was getting the reaction of the Teddy Boys, who then insisted on getting physical and beating me up, for example, when they saw me in the street. That was unfortunate.
Yeah, I did my university dissertation on Clockwork Orange, and the writer Alex Burgess was inspired a lot by the sort of the mods and the rockers fights that were going on down in Brighton in the 60s and then later with punk in the 70s. He said a lot of that street gang violence that was happening in Britain everywhere was what went into, you know, the Droogs gang violent mentality in that book. And it was kind of like taking your life into your own hands at that point, by all accounts, right? Occasionally, like if you looked the wrong way.
Well, it was, you did learn to avoid Teddy Boys, that's for sure. You know, at the time I lived in Hammersmith, and there were, one of their local pubs was the George, which meant it was very on Hammersmith Broadway, which means it was very hard to get home and avoid them because they tend to be gathering around outside. But it's just silly, really. Just such nonsense with... I wasn't in any confrontation with any other group of people, but they decided that they were.
You mentioned Iggy Pop earlier on, and you said at that stage you hadn't seen him perform live. You obviously later on would go on tour with Iggy, though, right? How was that? Were you a big fan of his before the tour, and tell me about watching him, and did you like learn anything specific from that tour with him, or take anything, you know, specific away from it?
I can't say I took anything specific away from it. I mean, I loved Iggy before, and I very much enjoyed the three or four gigs we did with him. He was in a very good period. I think he'd cleaned up. And he had a terrific band, and he was really peaking, of course, with Lust for Life and The Idiot, you know, terrific songs, a lot of influence from Bowie, and he took it on stage and really, really did it. So a fantastic honour to be part of that whole thing, to go on and support him.
And was he a cool guy? Was he nice?
I didn't meet him really. No, not really. Seemed fine, yeah. He did come in and introduce himself into our dressing room at one point, but I wasn't there.
Ships of the night. Tell me about the Explorers record. That's another one, I think, right after Channel 5. It's probably along with, I mean, those, basically for me, it's like the first two Adverts records, the Explorers record and Channel 5 are just like top tier. All just such amazing quality material. That record, again, it seems like you were expanding and taking the template that you'd already, you know, began with, and, you know, just evolving it even more. Do you have fond memories of making that album? And are you, again, like, with the benefit of hindsight, happy with the way it turned out and how it holds up?
Yeah, very happy with it. Yeah, and I enjoyed making it very much. Again, it felt very creative. Thing. It was a long time in the building, really, because after the adverts, there was a couple of lineup changes. I had Tim Cross straight into the Explorers at the beginning, and we had a very nice kind of setup with that. I had John Towin, who was in briefly in the adverts, and we had a fairly solid kind of lineup with those two and Colin Stoner and Eric Russell on guitar. But then Tim Cross got called away on a Mike Oldfield tour. John Tower decided he didn't want to do the be in a permanent band and move to France, I think. So we kind of got the band set and demoed it and everything, and then there was a lineup change, so that was quite disturbing. You know, it was like just a lot of work to rethink and work in a different keyboard player and a different style of drummer, and so then we had to kind of build up again. But by the time we got into the studio with it, we were pretty tight, and And yeah, as I say, a nice creative protest. We had nice studios. We had, you know, we were put into Ireland Studios and Britannia Row. So we had great sound, great engineers. Yeah, it was a good experience.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
There's something so unique about your sense of melody, particularly with those early albums. Where were you drawing from as a songwriter? And we'll perhaps get into some more of the lyrical themes in a bit as well, if that's all right. But just in terms of like song structure and melody, did you have any like big heroes or influences when you were finding your own voice that perhaps fed into the, you know, very distinct sound which you created?
Well, I do like to think that I don't have influences, because the whole thing is to be original. But what I have
which is
always
why
loved,
it is.
Well, I've always loved melody. That's the thing. You know, I've always loved melody and I've always loved lyrics. And so, yes, as I've already said, I loved Bowie when I was a kid. You know, I loved the Beatles when I was a kid. And I love Roxy and I love pop music and I love quite a few sort of prog bands as well. You know, I had a Yes record and Moody Blues and, you know, I had all sorts of records. I love music, but it had to have a melody. It had to have, you know, so I mean, I would, when I'd stop listening to the record, I could sing along, you know, I could sing it in my head. And so I would say it's just a conglomeration of all those kind of bands that I was listening to. And as I say, I always thought, well, don't copy, try and be your own songwriter. I think that if I was going to say anything that was an influence, if you hear my band before the adverts, Sleaze, which I made an album when I was still living in Torquay, going to art college. I had a band at art college, and we pressed up 50 copies of our record then, which I'd written all the songs for. I mean, it's very, very kind of Steve Harley, Cockney Rebel-ish, I've got to say.
Did you say you printed 50 records? Wow. Yeah. And are they out there? Do you ever come? Do you ever get people coming to your shows with one to sign?
Never happened.
No? They've got to be out there somewhere, though, right?
They're out there somewhere, yeah. And we did. I did actually have a repress of a few hundred in an American label, put them out, put it out again a couple of years ago. I was most surprised when they came to me and asked to release it. And that's actually stood up the test of time as well. It's been kind of my guilty secret for many years, but I really like it now. It's like a full album. It's only got six tracks on it. It's kind of like a mix between prog and glam rock. It's quite interesting, but it is quite derivative and it is quite long-winded and self-indulgent. But one of the tracks I then adapted and it went on the first Adverts album. So it is all a kind of process.
What's interesting to me about your work is whatever the musical template is, and there's been, you know, a lot of variety in that sense over the years, you can kind of always tell it's you from the melody and the voice. You have a very distinct original sound and you've explored many different musical terrains over the years, but there's always this sense that it's you in there. And I really enjoy that. Like, that's what drew me first to the Adverts when I first heard them, was your distinct voice, the distinct vocal attack, which is very like rhythmic and punchy as well. Like, it's quite an aggressive kick. Did you have singers or vocalists or, you know, performers that you looked to as, you know, being inspirational in any way?
No, not really. But I think that approach to singing developed out of the fact I always wrote on acoustic guitar. So the vocal always had to provide the percussion, really, the percussion and the rhythm. You always had to hit that. I think vocalists and songwriters, you write with a band in the rehearsal room with a band, they approach it in a different way. But I've only ever written with an acoustic guitar from Adverts onwards. I think that does mean somehow in your head, you're providing all that stuff, you know. The drums are coming in when you're thinking the word and the power of the words and the way they're going to explode out.
Was it quite easy for you then when you did go out and just start playing shows on an acoustic guitar, doing it solo after many years of being in a band? That obviously was like a totally seamless, not even a transition, just I'll just cut out the middleman and get out there, plug in, go.
Well, it was very difficult at first because I'd become so used to having a band behind me, and it was very scary experience walking out to the stage on your own. I mean, terrifying. But
no distortion to hide behind either, or volume, yeah,
whatsoever. That's the thing. You don't even realise you're hiding when you sing with a band, but you are. But when you're on your own with the guitar, there is no hiding place. You know, you've got to be 100%. You got to be 100% there. Not just, you know, in the way you play, but mentally, and, you know, the way you connect with the audience, you have to be absolutely fully there. And that becomes almost like a sort of kind of Zen challenge, you know, to be there for the audience and still keep all the songs in mind and present it in a way that works live. Like this podcast, there is no, you know, you can't erase it and go back when you make a mistake. You have to embrace. If you make a mistake, you embrace the mistake and that's it. And you carry on.
Yeah, I love that. I always used to think it's the one thing that we'll never replicate or download, right, is the live show. And then last year happens and everybody's streaming and you go, fuck, that was the one thing that I thought we couldn't. Obviously, it'll never be the same. You know, it's not the same as being in a room and having the audience there with you to, you know, connect with and vibe off. But yeah, it's the last, I think, area of creativity that is pure. You know, the streaming and the download revolution kind of killed the record business. But hopefully when the Rona is over, live shows will continue to be. I mean, for people like you, they must be the bread and butter of your life, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I have got, you know, I've really... It's another one of those things like getting a computer or a mobile phone. I thought I'd never do a streaming show, but as I've done more and more of them, I actually find that there is a kind of interesting buzz to doing a streaming show, and there are possibilities about live streaming that aren't available at a live gig. There are bonuses and positives to that too. You know,
you can reach anybody in the world, can't you? That's one thing. There's no cap.
There's one for a start. You know, people who can't get out to live shows for whatever reason. You have a global audience, not a local audience. You do it live, so any mistakes stay in. You know, there you go. So you're walking that tightrope again. And also I found that the choice of songs can be very interesting as well. I mean, I've been doing a live stream over the past 8 weeks and decided at the start not to play the same song twice. So over the course of 8 weeks, I've really trawled my back catalogue and played, you know, 160 songs, you know, of which probably 120 I would never approach a live gig, because, you know, at a live gig you do your 60 minutes or your 90 minutes of, and you choose the best stuff, that's just, you know, or the most popular stuff, you know.
Yeah, the people are coming and they expect to hear, you know, there's a certain five, let's say, that they would be disappointed if they didn't get.
Absolutely, those are the ones you have to play, and then there's another five or ten that they also will be expecting to hear.
Yeah.
And you know, I jiggle them around a bit and I put in the odd one that, you know, that you're not expecting, but nevertheless, journeying through the 150 songs I wouldn't normally play has been a really interesting, you know, and to hit the stuff from Channel 5 that I wouldn't normally play live, it's been great to revisit them.
Which songs from that record do you have a tendency to perform live?
None.
Really?
Mm.
Wow.
Again.
Every time we mention Channel 5, it seems to
be. Yeah, that's funny, isn't it?
The ghost in the machine.
I don't want to be talking to you in the dark. Well, I don't know what's... Work for me, baby. Come on.
I can't believe you don't play any. Why is that? Is that just because people you think aren't familiar with the record, or...?
They're not familiar with the record, and actually quite difficult to play live as well. I mean, they're quite complex songs, and yeah, basically just because most people don't know the record, you know, it's been very hard to get hold of, and I'll try and get this working for you. Cause I don't want
no
to
worries.
Speak. That's one thing you got to learn about podcasts is you have to light yourself as well.
I have a nightmare. I mean, the lighting in this room is not what you'd call professional, but as long as you can see me, I don't really mind. What was I going to say? Oh, so is there any way that you could somehow get back the songs from that album and re-record them? Is there any way you could reclaim ownership?
I could reclaim ownership, but the whole joy of the album is really the arrangements. So I think with Tim, the two Tims, Tim Cross and Tim Rennick, was a really magical kind of combination of talents coming together. I think that's what gives it its real taste and atmosphere.
Have they both passed on?
Tim Cross has passed on, yeah. My collaborator from many years. And I don't think you can really recapture the moment. You know, it was something very special when that album, like I say. When it's gone, it's gone. I move on.
Are you not somebody who looks back?
Not really, no. I mean, it's I like just getting on.
Yeah.
Getting on the stuff to do.
Well, I mean, as you said yourself, life's short, don't make a mess of it, right?
Indeed. Yeah. Well, I do like. I mean, as I say, I've enjoyed looking back at these live streams and revisiting some of those songs. And I did do an album of songs, just acoustically, acoustic sessions, Volume 1, and that, as the title so cunningly suggests, I hope there will be a Volume 2, and you know, I can revisit some of these songs just in an acoustic style. Solo acoustic style in the future, on however many acoustic sessions albums I care to make in the future.
You mentioned there you're not somebody who looks back. I want to just see if you can maybe change your mind on that from this last year and the streaming shows you've done. Obviously, in this time, I think a lot of people have been reflecting, and you know, without the distractions of travel and shows and things like this, you do tend to go in, I think, and you've been revisiting songs from the past. Was there any that you played and were really taken back to a specific time and place in your life? And was there any memories that, you know, really surprised you that perhaps you'd either forgotten about or were just really brought home in quite a beautiful way? Did you have any moments like that over the course of the streaming gigs that you did?
I wouldn't say specific moments of that, but the weird thing is it does bring you emotionally back to when, you know, when you revisit these old songs, it does bring you emotionally kind of into that era, into that period when you did them. So yeah, it's actually been quite, you know, someone mentioned Channel 5.
One night I played the song from Channel 5, Coming Round, ding, out.
Funny, I don't know what's going on.
I hope your light doesn't go out like this when you're doing your live shows, your streams, Tim.
No, it hasn't now, but it's got me worried.
Just the curse of this show then, it must be.
It's got me worried that that's what's going to happen, so it's good to do the checkout with you.
That's it, yeah. I'm your test run for tonight's show. How regular have you been doing those?
I did eight in a row, 8 weeks in a row, and I've done a couple before, and I kind of done a couple of Zoom shows as well. I think what I'm going to do is I'm just going to open the blind in this. Let the daylight in, which is going to be a bit. Going to be a bit variable, but at least
it's all good. Well, the video doesn't actually go out anywhere. I just do them over Zoom because I like to see the guest. It's just
is that right?
Yeah, it's only an audio show, so you don't need to look a million bucks.
In that case, people will not know what on earth we're talking about.
You were saying that there's certain places it was taking you in your head over the course of the shows where you were taken back to the memories, the emotions.
Yeah. I mean, I guess like doing the sleaze stuff or the pre-advert stuff was particularly kind of weird, you know, because they're quite doomy teenage angst kind of songs. And I find myself getting back into a doomy teenage angst kind of mentality when I'm playing them. I'm quite keen to get away from them, actually.
Music's mad like that, isn't it? Like it really does alter and affect your mood so profoundly. And because I'm very much like yourself, which I think is why I'm particularly drawn to your music. I'm not a musician, so I can appreciate structure and arrangements and chords and things like that to some extent, but I'm really all about the melody and the lyrics. That's where I get that connection to the music from. And it has such, I mean, every day for the last 4 months, every day without fail, I've gone out for a sort of 2-hour walk in the middle of the day, and I'll listen to like 3 or 4 albums in that time. And depending on what style of music I listen to, it will really shape the mood of the walk. And I've always been aware that obviously music does affect us in that way, but it's really been brought home to me this year just how much a specific song or turn of phrase even within the song can alter your state of mind.
Yep.
For better or sometimes worse.
when I'm in a writing phase myself, I never listen to any other music because it is so powerful that I don't want, you know, other people's creativity sort of inadvertently leaching into mine. So I basically shut down and don't listen to anything. In fact, I don't listen to very much anyway for that reason, because I'd rather be writing something than listening to something generally.
You're a tabula rasa.
I am a tabloid. Well, there's no need to be rude.
What about writers and, you know, thinkers and poets and, you know, people outside of music that have perhaps shaped your worldview or inspired you to go down certain avenues when, you know, exploring subjects and, you know, words? I'd love to get inside your creative mind a little bit in that sense, if you don't mind opening it up.
It's the old, like, what are your influences question, you know, and it's going to be the old, you know, I don't really have any influences answer, I'm afraid. I don't, you know, I've rigorously tried not to be influenced by anyone when I'm writing. You know, I'm sure there are plenty of musicians and plenty of writers and plenty of philosophers I've read, and you know, possibly I could even think of some if I put my mind to it. But I, you know, I don't know what I can say would be, you know, would have been a major influence on me.
Well, that's just as interesting an answer, and it really is just pure raw coming from you. So you're just reacting to the world around you.
That's what I try and do, Matt. That was for the audio only listeners. That was the sound of me opening the blinds. So I'm not on the
Tell me about your tour with my good friend Casey Chaos, who is a man who has many reputations. I adore him. He's been nothing but gold to me in my life. I've been out to Los Angeles many times over the years, and he's taken me around town and, you know, just shown me so much hospitality and generosity. I know he's a student and a disciple of the School of the Adverts. He absolutely adores your band and you as a songwriter. I guess it was like mid-2000s. Amen took you out on tour, right?
I did do a couple of dates with Amen, yeah.
How were they?
It was kind of weird. I mean, it was not an audience that I thought would really fit what I did, but he was so, he'd come on and introduce me and he'd virtually demand the audience like what I did. So it was kind of nice, you know, it was good. It's nice to play to new people as well who wouldn't have come to see me otherwise. I mean, it's only a couple of dates, but
was it in the UK or the US?
It was in the UK.
UK.
Yeah, I haven't heard from Casey for ages. He's certainly a man who lives up to his name of Chaos. But how do you know how he's doing? Is he okay?
Last time I saw and spoke to him, he was doing great. I mean, he's eternally working on what will become, hopefully, one day, a new Amen album. He's been working on it for so many years now with different drummers, and I think Ross Robinson's been producing most, if not all of it, with him. I haven't spoke to him since the coronavirus hit. I know he's alive and well because our mutual friend had a birthday party recently and he was there, but I haven't spoken to him since all of this hit. But I think something like this isn't going to really affect someone like Casey anyway, because he's so off the grid and own little universe. But by all accounts, the last time we spoke, he's just on fire creatively, writing every day, recording every day, and just being Casey, running around town, spending all his money on punk records in Amoeba and loving life. He's good. But yeah, he talks so fondly about the times he spent with both the Damned and yourself. You know, they're kind of like his life highlights in many ways, because he just loves UK punk so much.
Came over and did the Damned album live at the 100 Club, didn't he?
Yeah, that was, I think, the best show of his life, he said. He absolutely loved it. How were your shows with the Damned back in the day? I love that poster. I know it's kind of the thing of punk lore now, but the old adverts, no one chord, Damned, no three, come see your four at.
Yeah, very brilliant. Funny.
Were they very good guys back then?
Yeah, we got them fine. Yeah, the Damned are, you know, I loved that that first album. I love, you know, the songs that Brian wrote for it. And, you know, I love that classic lineup. So, they were on fire, summer of 77, the adverts were on fire, the audience were on fire, you know, it was a match made in heaven, really, those three pieces put together, sort of slammed together in the summer of punk, and so a very intense and memorable few weeks.
Well, you get down to their shows, obviously they were going to be performing as the original four last year, hopefully it will now happen this year. Is that a show you'd like to get down and see, or are you kind of not really interested in the reunion anniversary approach to, you know, classic lineups and bands? Because there's a lot of that now. It seems like that's all there is. It's like, here's the anniversary tour, here's the original lineup back together tour. Are you into any of that stuff?
I'm not particularly myself into it. Obviously, for my own part, an adverts reunion or anything like that would not be something I would ever do. My kind of interest is I occasionally do an advert set with my band from Spain, the Bored Teenagers, and that's kind of the nearest I get to you know, the kind of reunion vibe. You know, I did the Crossing the Red Sea album with them on my 50th birthday. Was it my 51st? I can't remember. But, you know, I'm now coming up to in a few weeks, I'm, a couple of weeks, I'm going to be 65, I think.
Wow. Yeah, yeah.
So, so I kind of have been kind of doing that for a while in my own way.
Yeah.
When
was the last time you spoke to Gail? Do you still ever talk to each other, or?
I haven't really spoke to her since I moved away, no.
So yeah, I presume you haven't played with her for many, many, many years.
Well, she put down the bass guitar at the end of the band and never picked it up again. And the drummer moved away to Iceland, and the guitarist, Howard, died from a brain tumour. So it's not a band that is about to reform, or, you know, definitively won't reform.
This new record that you put out last year, there's a couple of songs in there which I would love to just kind of explore and discuss a little bit with you, Artificial Flowers being one, because I'm having thoughts a lot like what you address in that song. The more and more time goes on, with going back to where we're, you know, perhaps starting the conversation out, we'll bring it full circle towards the end, but it just feels like in recent times we're losing so much of what makes life worth living. I know that sounds very melodramatic, but it just feels like we've lost so much, and we've lost our way so much, and there's so much insincerity and phoniness and division, and I just kind of, you know, I'll sometimes go online to message a friend or something, and we'll just see, you know, bullshit everywhere. And that song, you know, there's a couple of songs on the album which I think explore these things, but I wonder if you could shed some light on your thoughts on where we're at as, you know, humanity in 2021, what we've lost, what we could be doing more of, and what we could be doing better.
Well, I'd like to see more authenticity and more, you know, genuine kind of attitudes and discussion and emotion. And I do feel it's been subtly replaced by the fake and the shallow and the false, and it's been slipped under our eyes without us even noticing it. You know, we think we're looking at the real scenery, and in fact we're just looking at you know, at a stage set, and you know, that bothers me, because we're losing the danger is that we'll lose our ability to distinguish between what's real and what's not. You know, and at that point, you know, life really isn't worth living, because you are just becoming a kind of cog in their machine. And I think it's something we really have to guard against. We have to keep on, you know, keep smelling the flowers, for God's sake, you know, and get off social media, get out from behind the computer, and you know, as soon as you can, meet your friends. I know there's a lot of theories that this whole corona thing is a conspiracy to keep us isolated. I don't think it is, and I think as soon as we can get out and about, we've got to make sure we do, and we try and get back the values, you know, the humanity and the warmth of real social interaction that we had before all this started.
Amen to all of that. And I do feel as well like we're more divided at the moment as a, you know, certainly in the UK. I've got a lot of friends stateside who would say even more so over there. I can't speak for, you know, other parts of the world, but going on the references that I know, the US and the UK, it seems like both nations are so divided at the moment, politically, socially, everything. And, you know, we just need to, as you say, I think, get back out there and find that common ground, that middle ground, start from there and start trying to build some bridges, because, you know, the name calling and the mud throwing isn't going to get us as people anywhere, is it? It's just going to allow those up there to continue to consolidate. Yeah. And
I mean, it's absurd. Every question, you know, whether it's Brexit or the Conservatives or Labour or, you know, Republicans or Democrats, everything is coming down more or less 50-50. So it's like all one against the other, absolute confrontation. And there just doesn't seem to be, you know, any kind of compromise or bridge building, as you say, and it, you know, just both sides get irate with each other, and it just turns, life becomes just a phony war the whole time.
Yeah, there's a lot of online social justice warriors that are just trying to score more brownie points than those around them now, isn't it? That's what a lot of it's become. Rather than real change, it's just like, let's get on the internet and just, you know, look at how great I am, everybody. Look at me over here. Oh, he said something I don't like. He's cancelled. And you're like, oh, no, let's have a conversation here. Let's find some common ground.
Yeah. The real, you know, one of the real dangers of this last year has been that it's been a fantastic platform for the me generation on the internet. You know, personally, I can't wait for that to stop, you know.
Do you think alternative culture and alternative thinking still exists? You got a song called Join the Mainstream on the album, and I very much come from, you know, you were the punk generation, I was very much the 90s alternative rock generation. There's a lot of parallels between those two, artistically, musically, politically. And now it seems like alternative just means, oh, I've got blue hair. It's nothing to do with the way people think or feel. I'd love to get your thoughts on that as we approach the end. Do you think that alternative culture still exists in 2021?
My feelings about alternative is very much like my feelings about punk, which is, if you say you are, you're not. You know, if you have to put that title on yourself, you're not. The point is not to be a punk. The point is to be a good musician, to be true, to be, you know, to express yourself. You know, if you, the point about alternative is not to be alternative. You know, alternative is irrelevant. You know, again, the answer is to be true and to express yourself and to say what you believe. But the, you know, it's alternative to what? You know, a lot of these people,
the mainstream,
claim to be alternative. I mean, the thing is, the people out on the streets protesting against, you know, the poor dears having to be stay at home, you know, so they don't kill their granny with coronavirus. You know, the people protesting against Trump being booted out, you know, once that was my, I was aspiring to be out in the streets protesting, but I'm not going to go out in the streets and protest against those stupid things. You know, they're saying they're alternative. Well, you're not. You're the mainstream by being such an idiot. You know, so the title alternative has no meaning if you're just going along, you know, with the common crowd. You know, untested kind of ideas that have been fed to you. You know, that's why we're in this mess, because people are just accepting ideas fed to them. You know, if you're a real alternative, you're going to use your own mind and make your own judgment, not just have mainstream ideas fed to you and in the disguise of being alternative.
Hell yeah, I can get behind that, Tim. I want to thank you, first of all, for this great conversation. I hope it's been all right for you. I want to thank you mainly and firstly for just the wealth of music you've given the world. It's been the soundtrack to many a good time in my life. And I cherish those, you know, first four records that I said earlier. I need to get more into your 90s period. The thing that I love about doing this show is when I talk to people, I try and, you know, absorb myself into their world as much as possible in the lead up to the conversation. And in doing so, I get to discover loads of albums that I've, you know, overlooked for all these years. So I'm going to go in on the 90s solo period next, which I'm very excited about.
Certainly a lot out there, Matt. So, yeah.
There's a lot. And the new album's fantastic as well. And the song Lucky Ones that starts off the album, let's end there, because this has been a difficult, strange year. But the things you allude to in that song, it's kind of where I'm at spiritually, personally, at the moment. I feel like in the time that I've had off from touring and DJing and being out there hustling and earning like I usually do, I've had a lot of time to take stock and think about life. And I do feel gratitude and humility for so much. And that's exactly where I am. Is that sort of what you were suggesting with that song as you lead off into the album, is, you know, those of us that are here actually do have a lot to be grateful for?
I mean, you know, I was hit by coronavirus. I had 50 gigs cancelled, including some of the biggest ones I'd ever done in my life. But when I got out of bed you know, could finally get back on my bed, out of bed, and stand up and look at myself and see where I was. Well, I was alive, you know, and already that's, you know, that's point one, you know, and from that point on, you know, I've got a chance to build. I've got things to be positive about. You know, I wrote an album, I recorded an album, you know, I wasn't in some refugee camp, you know, with where no one cared about me, where I couldn't get any water and, you know, could be ill or dying, you know. Whatever you do, if you look at where you are and where you stand, you're lucky.
Yeah, if you start the day alive, that's pretty good, isn't it?
Start, isn't it?
Tim, thanks so much, mate. If people want to buy your music, check out what you're up to, support you, come see a show when they're a thing again, where is the best place for them to go on the wonderful World Wide Web?
Well, there's tvsmith.com, and I'm on the awful Facebook, which does seem to be the, you know, the best place to for things to happen. That's where I do the live streams when I do them. So TV Smith and Tim Smith, two different sites. I'm sure you can find me. You know, it's amazing the way Google works.
I always say that when people say to me, how do I listen to your show? Or I go, whatever question you have, just Google it, and the same applies. But we want to lead them right to the door, Tim. Make it as easy as possible. I hope to see you at Rebellion if that goes ahead and you're there as planned. And yeah, I do, whenever the opportunity arises, I do hope to see you at a show in the real world and shake your hand and say thanks in person. But thanks for a great chat, Tim.
Thanks, Matt. Nice to chat with you.
So loud. Now it's coming.